This is John Neuer from Mic Check Radio, and one of the best things about working for the Center for American Progress Action Fund is that when there's a complicated, thorny, or just difficult political issue that comes up in Washington, all we have to do to understand it is walk down the hall and grab one of the big-time smart people who also work at CAP. 5 questions, 10 minutes, and I'm up to speed, and now you are too with Progress That Goes 5 Questions for Somebody Smart. Andrew Jakubowicz, who is the Associate Director for Housing and Economics at American Progress, will be testifying this week about the Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP. Recently, the Obama administration has made some changes to HAMP, and Andrew was nice enough to take the time to come down here and walk us through the details of the modifications of the new program. Andrew, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today. So you are testifying this week in front of a subcommittee of the House Financial Services Committee, which is the Housing and Community Opportunity Subcommittee.
Yep.
So let's start out. So you're testifying about these modifications to HAMP.
Yeah.
Let's start at the beginning. Can you explain what is HAMP? And you know, when and why did it start?
Sure. So basically, HAMP is short for the Home Affordable Modification Program. It's part of the administration's broader Making Home Affordable initiative, which actually has a number of components. The modification program, HAMP, has a parallel program to allow people who are current on their loans to refinance if you have a mortgage that's backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. It's called HARP, the Home Affordable Refinance Program. You know, the sort of HA kind of allows for a lot of fun acronyms. So we've got HAMP and HARP. And then the other thing, obviously, that the administration was doing up until very recently was through the Federal Reserve Bank, was buying up mortgage-backed securities issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, really to keep interest rates affordable for a lot of folks. So people who were not eligible for any of these individual programs, a lot of people just refinanced because it was a good time to refinance because rates were really at historic lows. Right. And so taken together, all of these have really been an effort to help stabilize the economy, in particular the housing market, as people are running into problems. We're seeing delinquencies rising. We're seeing foreclosures rising. That has devastating impacts, obviously, not only for the people who are falling behind and are stressed on their mortgages, but obviously for their neighbors. As a home goes into foreclosure, it drives down the property values of everybody nearby. And so to protect communities and to protect blameless individuals, for the most part, from the effects of the collapse of the housing bubble, there's been an effort to really sort of shore up the housing market, ensure that money is still available for people to take out mortgages and to refinance, but also to keep people in their homes and to prevent foreclosures wherever possible. And really what the core of HAMP is, to get back to your original question, it started about a year ago is when the administration first announced it. I actually testified before the same committee back in March of 2009 as they announced the program and really provided an analysis then of what the program was going likely to be able to do. But basically, at its core, the idea is that everybody loses in a foreclosure. And so to the extent that there's room to adjust the terms of the loan,
right,
such
right,
that the losses that the owner of the loan, whether they're investors or the original lender who kept the loan on their own books. So let's give example for just to kind of put some numbers to this. These are obviously fanciful, but kind of give an illustration of the type of thing that happens under the program.
Sure.
So basically, let's say you have a $200,000 mortgage on a home that is now, because the housing market has declined, only worth $150,000. So you fall behind on your payments. You may have lost your job. The terms of your loan may have reset. Really, in most cases, at this point in time, a lot of people are falling behind simply because of high unemployment.
Right.
So either one
right,
or both workers in a family have fallen behind and have lost their wages. So you may have some unemployment income that you can put towards it, but one person in the family is still working, so there's still some income coming in, but not as much as when you originally took out the mortgage. You fall behind on your loan. You're having difficulty making your payments. And so you call up the servicer and say, hey, I want to apply for one of these HAMP modifications. And the servicer runs some numbers. They take your current income. You verify, you know, you show them pay stub and things like that.
Right.
They analyze what the house is worth now. So they come up and say, you know what, the house is now worth $150,000. We know you still owe us $200,000 on the house. 31% of your income is what the target monthly payment is under the program. So they factor in what that is, and they decide, they run these numbers, and they figure out if it's worth more to foreclose on the property. They'd make $150,000. The house is worth $150,000. Figure they take another, you know, $30,000 haircut after all the costs get factored in. That's
right.
What an investor or somebody who might buy the house after foreclosure is willing to pay. They factor in the fact that it's probably going to take them a while to sell the house. So they're going to take a significant loss. They're going to be out, let's say, $90,000 or $80,000 at the end of the day. So $120,000 off the $200,000. Then they sort of figure out what they can adjust your monthly payment down to be and what that would be worth to them over the long term if you assume you can continue to make your payments. And into both sides of those equations, they also factor in the likelihood that if they do nothing, you'll suddenly magically start making your payments again. And they also factor in the probability that even if they change your loan terms, you're going to ultimately go back into default. And so they're just going to delay the inevitable, but you know, not really make that much more.
Sure.
And so basically they say, okay, well, if we do nothing, we're going to get X. And if we modify, we're going to get Y. And if Y is bigger than X, you get a modification. So in theory, that's how it's supposed to work. And then basically what happens, again, in theory, is you get a three-month trial period. You make your payments for those three months, and then you're supposed to be offered a permanent modification, which would keep your payments fixed for the next 5 years, and it would slowly increase, but not particularly significantly. I think the increase can only be as high as about 5% interest at the end of the day. And under the modification program, the interest rate you can be paying for that five-year period can be as low as 2%. So there's a significant savings. And overall, there have been over a million people who've gotten into trial modifications. 170,000 people have gotten into permanent modifications. But the conversion to permanent has been very difficult. There's been lots and lots of issues around servicers really not complying and really not providing enough information back to the borrowers. So there are all sorts of issues with the program in terms of the compliance side of things. But overall, I think it's a good program. And I think that it's certainly necessary, but they need to be firing on all cylinders. And I think they need to really get the servicers to play ball.
So if we take a step back for a minute, and you started to go into this a little bit and how when you, you know, how foreclosed homes obviously affect the value of property in an entire neighborhood, in an entire zip code, but for folks who aren't in these terrible situations where you're underwater or you're unemployed, you can't afford the payments on a mortgage in a house that is worth less than what you bought it for, you know, what effect on a much more macro level do the problems with the mortgage industry, the problems in the housing industry, how do they affect the economy in general? Let's sort of take a much higher level view of,
sure,
of what has gone on and how it ties all of this together.
Well, I mean, very, very simply, not to sort of oversimplify things, but if you think about the role that mortgages play in the economy, the impact of jobs that have been lost to housing construction, real estate in general, it's a big sector of the economy, and it's basically dried up.
Right.
And so a lot of the unemployment has come from, sort of seeing job losses pretty much across the board. But very early on, as the economy was sort of tipping into recession, it was very clear that home construction, sort of those jobs basically gone away. And those are decent paying jobs, good paying jobs. What people have replaced those with are often much lower paying jobs. So even if you aren't unemployed, you're sort of underemployed. That's skilled labor by and large that isn't currently being useful,
right,
in the economy. So there's certainly those lost opportunities for people. People have definitely saved up. A lot of people's savings is tied up in the value of their homes. They were planning on sending their kids to college. They might have used that money to start a small business. Credit has basically dried up from that perspective. So really stabilizing the housing market has much broader effects on the economy in general, especially if you sort of think about people's willingness to spend in general. I mean, we've gone from a nation of spenders back to a nation of savers, and I think by and large, that's a good thing. But to the extent that the pendulum has swung a little bit too far.
And too fast.
And too quickly. Yeah. I mean, and certainly we're at risk of overcorrection in the housing markets. I think that there's obviously benefit in stabilizing the economy through stabilizing housing markets, because as people feel more comfortable in the value of their homes, they don't think they're going to be underwater in perpetuity. they're less likely to decide, you know what, it's not worth me paying off this mortgage, which then again creates this domino effect of other people going, hey, wait a second, if my neighbor's not making his mortgage payments and is going to walk away, why am I still paying on this thing? Let me go rent someplace.
Yeah, and not only that, but now your home after your neighbor walked is worth less.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the spillover effects are quantifiable and they're quite large.
Yeah.
And so right now you're looking about a quarter of all borrowers who are underwater on their mortgages. And I think that has huge impacts on, again, people's ability to send their kids to college. So there are generational impacts that flow from this, not just simply a here and now.
And homes, at least in the not too recent past, were looked at as investments.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the problem as well. I mean, I think people were sort of overly reliant on inflating values of homes for a lot of things. And in part, that's because wages were stagnant for basically the entire decade. And that's sort of in part and parcel of the, you know, sort of one of the tragedies of the economy under the Bush administration was the fact that in real dollar terms, people were doing worse when he left office than when he took office. And so consumption was basically driven by people using their homes as ATMs. So that in part was some of the problem, but a lot of the people who were running into problems were people who were being responsible. I think there's a misconception out there that particularly among low and moderate income people, that you're really talking about people who were, you know,
beyond their means,
beyond their means. Yeah. They were doing, you know, all these ridiculous things. They only got into these loans because they were exotic. The truth is, most people who were given these exotic loans would have qualified for more conventional financing or at least less exotic loan products. But again, there was not a lot of oversight. The regulators weren't looking after this. There's no consumer financial protection out there. There's no fiduciary duty of a mortgage broker to the borrower.
Right, this may not be a great idea.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they make more money. The higher the interest rate they can charge you, the more money they make off the deal. And so from that perspective, the lack of a watchdog, anybody really looking out for the consumer's interest, I think also helped feed this spiral.
So let's finish off with sort of a two-part question, or two different questions, if you will. Back to HAMP, which you are testifying about this week. Let's talk about what are some of the modifications now versus when it was originally instated. So that's one of the things you're testifying about. And in your testimony, you say that these changes are good, but they're not as good as it can be, basically. So that's the second part of the question. So the first part is, what are some of these new, what are some of the changes now?
Sure. So basically, what they've done is there are a couple of pieces to this. But under the current system, the way the HAMP model works now, there's this, what they call a net present value test, this NPV test that I alluded to earlier, where they kind of evaluate what it's worth if they do nothing, as opposed to what it's worth if they make the modification. And the way they run those numbers is what they do is, again, working off 31% of your income, they figure out sort of how to adjust the terms of the loan so that way your monthly payment meets that 31% target. And so what they do is first they will drop the interest rate as low as 2%, and then they'll extend the length of the loan out to 40 years. And then they'll set aside part of the amount that you owe every month, what they call forbearance. So basically, instead of, let's say, again, going back to that mythical $200,000 mortgage, so instead of saying, okay, you're paying interest on $200,000, they'll say, look, we're going to take $20,000, put it on the side. You owe interest on $180,000, and when you either refinance or sell the house, you still owe us that last $20,000.
Yeah. It'll help you with your monthly payments.
Exactly. Exactly. So throughout that sort of waterfall process, in terms of the steps that they take, they basically say, look, at any point in time, a servicer can choose to forgive the principal. So let's take that $20,000. So instead of setting it on the side and say, okay, you don't owe interest on it, in fact, will forgive it entirely. So, and the way they would do that would be stepped in over 3 years. And this is something they're building into this addition, is say, look, that $20,000, here's how the forgiveness would work. We'll set the $20,000 aside. As long as you stay current on your loan, we're going to knock off that $20,000 and sort of, I guess, you know, $6,333 or $6,666, you know, we get knocked off every year.
I'm in communications. I don't do math, but I believe you.
That's the 20
grand. You could have lied, and I would have I would have believed you.
Right. So that's basically the way that's the way this new forbearance would work. But instead of it kind of going anywhere you'd want it to go, mm-hmm. what they'll do is they'll run the NPV test sort of under the current program, and then they'll run the test again, but putting the principal forgiveness up front. And the argument is, and I think that it makes sense to do the forgiveness. First of all, people are underwater on their homes. If you're knocking down the principal, then they're less likely to walk away. So the value of the NPV test goes up because the redefault rate for the modification goes down. So the odds of you continuing to pay improve.
And if they walk, you're going to lose that money anyway.
Exactly. Exactly.
And more.
Right. So that's one of the arguments for doing this write-down is that you're really trying to balance those sort of competing factors.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, a lot more people, I think, will be able to be helped by doing the principal write-down. Now, one of the challenges is that it's voluntary. So even if it's more valuable, servicers don't have to do it. And in some cases, look, there are, in fact, they're precluded by contract with investors that say, you know, only a certain number of loans can be modified this way, et cetera. But one of the problems is that the investors never find out exactly what's going on. They get a check at the end of the month of whatever the amount is, and they have no idea exactly why that amount is coming to them.
Right.
There's no transparency in the process that investors can say, no, I want you to be doing the principal reductions. And investors actually have come forward, again, because of this redefault risk. And the other thing is that investors like the principal reduction because if I'm sort of now above water on my loan, I could potentially refinance, right? So the investor who lent out this money, you know, thought the bond was basically going to last about 7 years. It's the sort of typical prepayment curve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a pool of loans tends to, in the whole, kind of disappear after about 7 years as people move or refinance.
Sure.
But if all the borrowers are suddenly trapped in their homes because they've got 40-year mortgages now that they're underwater on, the only way that they're going to get above water is basically by paying off the equity, you know, 20, 30 years from now.
Right.
Nobody's going to refinance out of that. And so the investors have their money on the hook for much, much longer and have to now take on interest rate risk that they weren't previously willing to take. So investors like this principal reduction, but part of the problem is that the investors have only limited capacity to see what the servicers are actually doing and to actually force them to take to do the principal reductions even when the principal reductions is more valuable.
So to segue, obviously, one of the problems to the last question is, you know, what more can be done? Obviously, one of those things is transparency.
Yeah, I think transparency is absolutely critical, and that's sort of been a problem with the program throughout, that the model that's being used is not public at all, so there's been no debate or discussion as to whether the inputs are appropriate or realistic. The servicers, the degree of disclosure and transparency that they have to offer when they deny a borrower still pales in comparison to really the type of disclosure that you would want to be able to see if they're actually living up to their obligations. And so I think one of the things that can be done to really improve this entire process is really to have Treasury, instead of consistently deferring to servicers, is to basically actually control the process themselves and to basically build a web portal. There are a couple of different platforms out there that different services are actually starting to use and housing counselors are using. But basically have a centralized place where Treasury can really control the process and they know exactly how long it takes for servicers to respond to borrower requests. One of the problems is that servicers constantly claim that borrowers sent in incomplete packets, that things never got sent when, you know, the borrower sent it 35 times. There's no appeals process. So it makes compliance checking really an after-the-fact sort of thing as opposed to a real-time sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I really think that having a centralized portal that Treasury controls, if they make changes to the NPV model over time also, they can roll out these changes very quickly and easily instead of having to send it out and then giving the servicers enough time to revamp their entire computer systems, et cetera, to be able to deal with the new model. This way, Treasury's got it. They make the change, and boom, as of the next day, you're using the new system. So I think there are a lot of benefits to having Treasury actually taking a much more hands-on approach. And again, if they don't have the staff, there are ways to find third-party you know, it's third-party software vendors who kind of run these things. The compliance folks would have an easier time because it's all centralized. So I think there are a lot of benefits to having really a central location. The Treasury really is taking a much more aggressive role in ensuring compliance. I think that there are other things that can be done, but in terms of really getting the program itself to achieve the numbers that I think everybody really wants to see happen, Treasury's got to be a lot more aggressive about getting the servicers to comply with the existing program.
And then, you know, in the end, it's a win-win-win-win. I mean, it sounds like it is.
It is. And it's not to be sort of Pollyannish about it, but it's designed really to modify when modification provides the best value.
Right.
So, unfortunately, there are homeowners whose just incomes are just, you know, again, because of unemployment and things like that, are just not sufficient to sustain even an adjustment down to 31% of income. There is some sort of push now to say, look, let's try it at 25. There's no reason why we have to be wedded to this 31%. And even some of the banks are willing to go a little bit lower, you know, particularly if Treasury is going to subsidize some of the buy down of the cost, which is what they do to get to the 31%.
Right.
But overall, I think it's a good program. And so I think that a lot of the efforts to improve it are because there is a lot of buy-in for it. And so I think that hopefully over the next coming weeks, we'll see, again, some stronger guidance about some of these issues that I've raised and that some of the other folks who are testifying are going to raise.
Well, Andrew, we really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Andrew is the Associate Director for Housing and Economics at American Progress, and we're so, so glad that we have smart people like you who can follow this stuff that is way over our heads. So we appreciate you coming in and talking
to us. Thanks for having me.
And that's today's Progress It Goes, 5 questions for somebody smart, where we walk down the hall and grab one of our big-time smart people here at CAP to catch us up on some of the trickier issues facing Washington. Progress to Go is a product of Mike Check Radio and the Center for American Progress Action Fund. So for these kinds of stories and many more, you can check us out at MikeCheckRadio.org.